can't forget about that either.
There we go. There we go. Okay. Well, I'm going to call the meeting of the Ocean Protection Council to order and acknowledge that we have Undersecretary Gordon Burns here for Matt Rodriguez. We have Kevin Schmidt here for Gavin Newsom. Bill Craven is here for Fran Pavley. Taylor Glass is here for Bill Quirk. Michael Brown is here for himself. And Geraldine Matz is out of the country and sends her apologies for not being here today. On the sort of welcome and council member announcements, I had a few things to just mention off the top at the beginning. First, this last weekend was California Coastal Cleanup Day. I know that many people here participated. Five members of the Ocean Protection Council staff drove down and joined me in Santa Cruz County to clean up in that area. There was an incredible turnout, and that was a wonderful thing. It was almost, I don't know how many tons last year, and they were really working to match it this year. And the first returns were that an incredible amount of stuff had been picked up, and we really highlighted where we were, the fact that 20% of the sites aren't directly on the coast. They're in places that drain to the coast, where you collect things that won't end up being on the beach or in the ocean. And so, just to everybody that participated, thank you. That was a wonderful day. Secondly, and this is a wonderful coastal issue, but it reflects a certain provincialism of the chair. The Big Blue Live, which BBC and PBS did for three nights live from the Monterey Bay area right at the beginning of the month, was a smashing success. And it was amazing to see them out with whales breaching porpoises there in kelp beds, with sea lions not leaving them alone underwater, with great whites being able to be photographed from the helicopter, amazingly just feet from people frolicking on the beach while it was going on, which was a statement in itself about coexistence. And it was remarkable. And I think I had an op-ed that I know is in our agenda packet that was carried by the Sacramento Bee, but you just look at 50 or 100 years of organizing, whether it's Doc Ricketts or Margaret Owings or the broad effort to establish the marine sanctuary, to not do oil drilling within the marine sanctuary, to do the Marine Life Protected Act with areas around that are in protection, to do the Management Act, which says we will not look at individual species but entire ecosystems. It was all that work that led to the point that there was something in the Monterey Bay that people wanted to come see. So I think the brief moment in the spotlight was ritually enjoyed, and as we will hear a little bit in an update from this morning's talks about El Nino, they were measuring the temperature of the water in the Monterey Bay, and it was 4 to 5 degrees above normal due to the current conditions, and that was in part contributing to some of the things that were going on. Then also, I wanted to, in this forum, acknowledge the passing of Zeke Grader. And for those of you that might not have known him or had the pleasure to. He was with the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations for 39 years. And I got to know him in the 1980s when we were both working against offshore oil development on the Central Coast and in other places in California. And he was just tireless. I think if there's anything that has gone right in California about salmon, it's because Zeke had a hand in it, and he was a tireless advocate. And I remember times when I went to the NOAA listening session on ocean issues and coastal issues that was held a couple of years ago. Zeke always had this line about marine protected areas that that many other things needed to be done. And he walked in, and there were 300 people sitting there, and I looked right at him and said, you know, there's somebody that says many other things need to be done. That's exactly right, but it doesn't mean we don't do this as well, and we fit them all together. And he smiled across the room. And when I did the bill in the legislature that somebody I'm looking at referred to, I wanted to co-manage fisheries until we could get MPAs in place, and somebody I was looking at used to refer to it as MLPA light. When I did that bill, Zeke made the comment that he had questions about this, but he didn't really want to take on this author. And so we just had a relationship of many years that I enjoyed, and he will truly be missed. And I just wanted to make sure it's impossible to have a meeting about oceans and the coast without mentioning Zeke. Just before I ask if other council members have comments or announcements, I want to remind everybody that this is live webcast. So it's important to monitor your cell phones in a way that they are not part of the live webcast. We're going to take public comment on items 4, 5, and 6, and allow for a public comment at the end. I was informed that however we got there, today our 3-minute timer is the one that actually buzzes at 3 minutes. Usually we get the quiet one. So just wanted to warn you, you will be competing against the buzz if you go for the full 3 minutes. At the back of the room, you'll find speaker cards. Please fill one out for each item you wish to speak, and if you want your name actually pronounced correctly, make sure that your name is legible on the card, because I have had issues with that. And the OPC staff will take the cards at the front of the room. With that, I would ask if any other council members had anything to say or announcement or comments before we move on with our meeting. Seeing none, then we will move to the executive director's report. Kat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to pass on executive director remarks this afternoon.
And if you could pull the mic a little closer.
I'm going to pass on executive director comments and urge you to take a look at the report. And in favor, cede my time to Dr. Daniel Rudnick from Scripps. Dr. Rudnick is currently a professor and formerly deputy director of education at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He is an observational oceanographer whose research focuses on processes in the upper ocean, and he has agreed to be the spokesperson from this morning's panel of distinguished professors and colleagues from Department of Fish and Wildlife, who gave a really excellent panel on El Nino and its impact on living marine resources. We had altogether about 180 people attending that workshop, many on the phone. Interesting dialogue and questions. And with that, Dr. Rudnick, I will turn it over to you for a summary.
Thank you very much, Ms. Pullman. And thank you to the Commission for allowing me this time. Is it on? Oh, keep it closer? Okay. I'm sorry. All right, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you today. Today we did have a workshop on El Nino and its effects on California living marine resources. And so what I'd like to do in my few minutes right now is to tell you what happened there and let you know what you should know about El Nino and its effects on California. So what is El Nino and what is going on this year? That's the first question. Well, El Nino involves changes in the equatorial Pacific that include warming of the surface waters. Now, an important thing to know is that El Nino is felt across the Pacific from Asia to the Americas. And so we also feel it off California, but it is felt everywhere. We have had some very strong El Ninos in the past. The ones that people who are old enough will remember are in 82, 83, and in 97, 98. Anybody who's been around long enough remembers those. Those are the kinds of things my neighbors ask me about. The last moderate El Nino, though, was in 09-10, and that did not have such strong effects off California. You may not remember it as well, but it sure was an El Nino, just a weaker one. Well, we do have an El Nino right now. NOAA has made it clear that we do have El Nino conditions at the equator. It's official. And there are forecasts now of what will happen next, and they're overwhelming in saying that this El Nino will persist through the winter, and it could be a very strong El Nino. But over the models are out there saying with a 95% certainty, El Nino will persist through the winter. So what are the effects of El Nino in California's oceans? Well, the most obvious effect is warmer water. And we've already seen that actually for the past few years preceding this El Nino that we've had very warm waters. Well, because the reason for the warm waters is essentially that there's less upwelling. There's less wind to drive upwelling that brings up cooler waters that bring nutrients and help the ocean to be biologically productive. So now this causes problems for some of the organisms in the ocean. It's actually good for others. So there are both winners and there are losers in the oceans. One of the things that happens is that the distribution of species changes. So, for example, a winner for local folks is that tropical species like tuna move north, and so recreational fishermen tend to be fairly happy during El Nino years. On the other hand, market squid, which is a major fishery here, declines. There are sea lions, as have been seen on the news over the past year, that have poor diets because of the changes. Sardines move closer to shore. And we'll learn about a mixed story about sardines in just a minute. So they're just both winners and losers from El Nino. Managers use the information about past El Ninos and what we're learning about this year's El Nino to make decisions to monitor and assess these various fisheries I've just discussed. But I guess a bit of good news is that at least in the past, any changes to fisheries in response to El Nino have usually gone back to normal within a few years. So now the elephant in the room whenever we speak about El Nino is, of course, precipitation. And everybody does want to know what's going to happen there. And I can say that in 82, 83, 97, 98, those were strong El Ninos and there was strong precipitation. We remember that. But however, there is not a strong correlation in general between El Ninos and precipitation, just that the strongest ones do bring rain. Well, with the current forecast for a strong El Nino, we'll see. You know, there are no guarantees that there will be more precipitation, but the last two strong ones had it, so we will see. Well, with strong precipitation is strong stream flow, and now we come to salmon, and that's good for salmon. So salmon may very well benefit, but considering the really terrible conditions from the past few years for salmon, again, we'll see how they fare. All right, now I want to close with a few comments on where California stands and what we should do moving forward. Cal Coffee and other observing systems off California have put us in an excellent position to both understand El Nino and to manage its effects. So we have a number of both challenges and opportunities because of this El Nino, both challenges and opportunities. And so here they are. There are three of them. First, we have an opportunity to enhance observations so that we can understand this El Nino. so that we can use knowledge about this one to prepare better for the next one, just as we're preparing for this one with knowledge of what happened in 82, 83, and 97, 98. We can improve our analyses of the observations we're making now and more that we may make in the future so that we can manage the physical environment and living marine resources better. And finally, we can increase the communication between scientists like myself and folks who have to do the management and policy making. And today's workshop was a first step towards that. So thank you very much. That's my summary.
I appreciate that very much. And do people have questions or comments? I'm sorry, Michael.
Thank you for the observation. I was at the workshop this morning, and it was really good. I got to say, I learned. I thought I knew about El Nino, but I definitely learned a fair amount. And just wanted to ask what kind of push you a little bit to say what would be the top two or three policy issues that you see coming out of all this work on observation and analysis?
Okay, so let me preface this by saying I'm not a policy person. I'm just a scientist. But what do I think will happen? Okay, so concerning the changes in distribution of species, it seems like we're getting better at figuring out what happens to species during these climatic changes. And I think one of the things that should be an improvement in how we manage species is to get better information so we can do ecosystem-based management, management that's based on the whole ecosystem, not just the one species at a time. I think that is something that will improve. I actually think that, I don't know if this is a policy, but maybe it's an opportunity, is that right now we have the attention of the public with El Nino looming. And for us folks in the scientific business, this is an opportunity for us to educate, because people are looking at their weather reports now. And maybe this is a great opportunity for STEM education while everybody everywhere is watching what happens to the Earth as it changes in response to El Nino, because the changes are quite widespread. Maybe this is an opportunity for some improvements there as well.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Well, that's remarkable that we don't. Thank you, and thanks to everybody in addition to you that was there today and really came to participate. I think it was really helpful.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to address the commission.
All right. Then we are going to move to item number 3, which is the report from the science advisor.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair, Council members. My brief remarks, I hope, will actually build upon what's already been said here this morning, the workshop discussions that were held and the summary that was provided. And I want to tease apart a thread that I hope kind of pulls together my updates for this morning.
And, you know, Liz, we managed to get all the way through without you saying your name or your affiliation. So just for the record, why don't we do that?
For the record, Liz Whiteman, California Ocean Science Trust, Science Advisor to the Ocean Protection Council. And so coming back, the thread that I want to pull out and provide just brief updates from our last meeting is one that's been said, but I'll say it explicitly, that El Nino has been a little bit of a push to get better at planning together, shortening the distance between the scientific community and the policy management decision-making community. And we've heard already how the scientific community is responding, offering new data, new models, new tools, coming together in new collaborations to learn from past events and also to make sure, damn sure, that we learn from this event as it plays out. And this thread, I think, is important because the same needs apply to the longer range effects of climate change and a changing ocean environment. So just to give some examples, the updates, you know, as places of resilience and living laboratories, our network of marine protected areas serves as a foundation for tracking climate change impacts, including those from ocean acidification and hypoxia, recovery from associated environmental disasters, and associated events such as disease outbreaks that may be some of those tangential knock-on effects of an El Nino. California is investing in that effort, and we'll hear more, I know, on the agenda later this afternoon about new milestones that are being reached in California's effort to implement its MPAs in new ways through new collaborations, cross-sectoral and cross-jurisdictional. Turning to fisheries, you know, with your support, your science advisory team is also stepping up to the plate to launch a new effort to examine the effects of climate change on fisheries management in collaboration with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. So to provide, if you like, a roadmap so that we can think about this complex suite of changes and begin to unpack and think through how you take account of that in the various stages of fisheries management, from the fish themselves to the human communities to the governance infrastructure that surrounds it, so that we can build approaches that build sort of resilience in all of the above. And again, that's going to take these new collaborations and new ways that the scientific community, through your science advisory team, is coming together on this issue. And as we heard this morning, El Nino is expected to interface with fisheries and provides, again, another sort of push to start these conversations that will be durable for the long haul. On a changing ocean chemistry front, the Pacific Coast Collaborative, a body that brings West Coast leaders together on for a common front on climate and energy issues, is taking what we're learning from the Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel and using that to build partnerships with our federal partners. And the panel's work is forming the basis. So science is forming the basis of new collaborations with NOAA, US EPA, and the National Ocean Council. And that's a, you know, new way of working together, scaling up beyond our state boundaries with science as a foundation that is, again, sort of putting the pieces in place for the future. So I'll just close by saying I think we have many of the tools, and El Nino is forcing us to act upon them and work together in new ways. And so while we don't know and what will happen with El Nino, and there will be winners and losers, I think we can put pieces in place that will carry us through and serve us well in the long term. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Yes, Taylor.
Thank you for the summary. With respect to the ocean acidification, has there been much modeling done on, you know, if we can reduce GHG emissions and carbon that's being, you know, absorbed in the ocean, can we counteract that, you know, decrease in the pH? Will it normalize?
Great question, and I should also, you know, allow Kat to pile on here, who's advancing much of this work. From a science perspective, that's the question that often comes to the scientists. This is a global problem. What on earth can we do locally, and how can we understand how to act locally, even if local is an entire state, for example? And so California has actually prioritized modeling efforts that will begin to unpack the local drivers of ocean acidification. Change is going to come because of global changes in carbon dioxide. So what we need to understand then is how in California we can act, you know, at a state scale or even more locally. And those models have been invested in by the Ocean Protection Council and others and are underway now.
No follow-ups. Bill.
Just to follow up on that question, any early information on that?
Alas, no. The modelers are well at work. We would hope to be having some report outs, I would say, from them in a year from now. We also found out that US EPA is paying for a similar study in Puget Sound. And so one of the things we're looking at is putting both of those together, because the Puget Sound, we're looking at the Southern California Bight, which is a big, huge open water system. The EPA study is looking at septic tanks in a near shore environment. And both of those are different kinds of situations that we may or may not have different management responses because of the physical situation.
I think it might be good, even as part of a written director's report, to have more regular updates from the scientists and the people that are sort of working on this, because I hear about it anecdotally, but it would be nice in this more formal setting, especially since we meet every 3 or 4 months, to have updates so we bring everybody along on where that is and what people are learning. Thank you. Anything else for the science advisor? Then we're going to move to item number 4, which is consideration of adoption of Proposition 1 grant guidelines. And just before it goes over to Amy, I would say the obvious thing that she's probably going to start with, which is that the voters approved Proposition 1 by 2/3 of the vote last November. And there is a certain segment in there for oceans. But this was a bond globally that was different than a lot of previous resources-related bonds or water bonds, in that it is specific pots of money for certain things. It is a merit-based application system for much of it, and it is not sort of a series of earmarks. And for every single pot, and the reason I say that, because it's not just oceans, there is a public process for establishing the regulations for how the money will be dealt with heading out the door. And so while we are seeing this come to us and hopefully get to the end of the regulation process for the Ocean Protection Council on Prop 1, this has been going on for recycling. It's going on in a separate type of way for storage. It's going on for just many different things that are part of the bond, and that is the reason for this process. So, Amy?
Great. That was a wonderful introduction. So good afternoon, Chair Laird, members of the Council. My name is Amy Vieira. I'm the Deputy Director for the Ocean Protection Council. And joining me in this presentation today is Nick Sajapur, a Sea Grant Fellow with our office here. And we're very pleased to be before you for you to consider adoption of the Prop 1 grant guidelines. I'm going to present some context about Prop 1 and its allocation to the Ocean Protection Council. I'll talk a little bit about our process to solicit public comment, and then review our proposed process for grant solicitations. Nick is going to highlight some of the public comment that we received and how we incorporated that, and he'll also give more detail about the proposed scoring criteria. So council members are probably familiar with this, but for members of the public, again, as Secretary Laird just said, the voters passed Proposition 1, which is also known as the Water Quality Supply and Infrastructure Act of 2014. That passed in November 2014. And it's largely intended to fund projects which advance the objectives of the California Water Action Plan. Prop 1 allocates $30 million to the Ocean Protection Council and requires a competitive grant program for multi-benefit water quality, water supply, and watershed protection and restoration projects. Specifically, OPC's allocation is from Chapter 6 of Proposition 1, which is entitled Protecting Rivers, Lakes, Streams, Coastal Waters, and Watersheds. The legislature in this fiscal year has appropriated the Ocean Protection Council $9.3 million for grants, and we anticipate receiving a similar allocation in FY 2017-18 and then again in FY 2019-20. So these are the 13 purposes of Chapter 6 of Prop 1, and we realize this is hard to see, but this is in let's see, Appendix B of the proposed grant guidelines. The purposes are focused on healthy watersheds, ecosystem improvements, and protection projects. It traverses a variety of environments. In our case, most relevant are coastal watersheds, bays and estuaries, and the nearshore environment.
I feel like telling the optometrist that I can read down to line number 6.
So in addition to the purposes of Chapter 6, OPC staff has articulated the following 5 key issue areas, which are based on our strategic plan, which go from 2012 to 2017. So first of all, marine managed areas. We would like to improve the ability for marine managed areas to meet their statutory goals. And we're using the term marine managed areas very purposefully. We're talking about both areas such as areas of special biological significance that the State Water Board manages, as well as the marine protected areas that were designated out of the Marine Life Protection Act. We are interested in coastal and water quality impacts. We want to reduce the amount of pollution and contaminants that are entering our coastal and ocean ecosystems. Some sources include stormwater, non-point source discharges, agricultural runoff. We're very interested in the issue of marine debris and seeing a measurable reduction in marine debris. We're interested in innovative marine and estuarine fisheries management, sustainable fishery practices that support and enhance marine and estuarine ecosystems with clear links to Proposition 1. Climate change, there's 2 areas that we're interested in. Sea level rise, we want to reduce the amount of risk and improve the resiliency of both the built environment and natural environment in the face of sea level rise, and ocean acidification and hypoxia, in particular, reducing stressors to the marine and coastal ecosystems. So successful applicants will or should be able to demonstrate both the relevancy of the project to Chapter 6 of Prop 1, but also these identified key areas. So next, just a little bit of context about the process that we went through to develop these grant guidelines. The first draft was posted to the OPC and the Bond Accountability web pages on May 21st. Prop 1 has a requirement that the entities receiving funds hold at least 3 public workshops in Southern, Central, and Northern California. We did that. And you can see the dates here, June 24th in Sacramento, July 14th in Costa Mesa, and August 11th in Eureka. We also facilitated or participated in other outreach opportunities. We participated in a tribal information session that was coordinated by Department of Water Resources in early June. And then based on comments we received there, we had a webinar for tribal representatives only for them to give us feedback about the grant guidelines. And then the public comment period ended on August 21st. So this slide is intended to show at a very high level the process that we envision for the application process. Nick will go into more details about each of these steps. So we designed this process to begin with a letter of intent. And that letter of intent template is in your materials. It's Appendix E. And we decided to choose this route because we were hearing from folks that, you know, grant applications are onerous, they're time-consuming, there's communities such as low-income communities that don't have the resources to be able to dedicate to this effort. And so we designed this letter of intent process to be something that could be filled out like in an afternoon. And at least give the applicant some initial feedback about whether their project is consistent with our grant guidelines. So the first step in the process will be that the letter of intent will be screened against basic criteria of Prop 1, such as, is the applicant eligible under the law? And those types of questions, kind of yes or no types of questions. If it passes through that screening test, it then goes through scoring criteria. And the scoring criteria is aimed at assessing whether and to what degree the project meets the requirements of Prop 1 and the OPC key issue areas that I talked about earlier. If letters of intent pass a certain threshold score, 75 or better, we then invite them to return a full proposal to us, and I believe we're giving applicants about 3 months to do that. The full proposal will then be scored against another set of criteria. Again, Nick is going to go into that in more detail. But the purpose of that is to really assess the project in more detail. Has the project proponent developed a scope of work, a budget, a schedule that demonstrates that it's a well-thought-out project and that the grantee can deliver? The full proposal will be evaluated by a review panel, which will be formed based upon the subject area of the proposals we receive. And then, again, it will be scored, and staff will bring back to the council the highest scoring projects for your consideration. And the council is required to approve any grants before they move forward into the grant execution process. So now I'll turn it over to Nick, who is going to summarize the major themes that emerged from public comment, and we'll go into greater detail about the scoring criteria.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
I can't even read down to line number 6 in this one.
That's okay. So as Amy mentioned, my name is Nick Sadrapour. I'm a Sea Grant Fellow with the Ocean Protection Council. I work a lot on Prop 1, and taking it from the public comment standpoint, we did receive, as you can see, quite a bit of public comment from line item edits to general guidelines, and that's just the first page. Essentially, many people did support the process we have laid out in our guidelines, in particular the letter of intent, and we feel that that gives applicants a good shot to see if the project fits and meets the criteria of Prop 1, of Chapter 6 of Prop 1, as well as the OPC guidelines. Other comments were geared towards the multi-benefit factors, the multi-benefit piece of the grants, which we heard from quite a few individuals, and that is one of the main points of Prop 1 in Chapter 6. We also did hear a lot of support that we were emphasizing marine managed areas in our guidelines. So here again, a little summary as far as what comments we heard. Marine managed areas prioritize those more, multi-benefit projects, really incentivize those, and general support for the letters of intent. So the revisions we did between the draft and the final, the proposal you have before you, are we have included an interagency component, and I should reiterate that we did receive that as a large comment from many different stakeholders, that they felt that an interagency piece of different agencies receiving Prop 1 funds could help leverage the state funds, state resources, and provide better projects for the future. And that's something that we've incorporated within our letter of intent. That's a little checkbox. You can identify different agencies that you've either submitted your project to or you feel your project can overlap with. And we've begun talks with different agencies about how to logistically do that. And we're looking to meet with them in the near future to decide how that actually plays out. Other revisions is that we've increased the points for the marine managed areas. And we've reformatted the evaluation for the multi-benefit piece. We've changed it from a simple 5 benefits, you get points for each benefit, to a more comprehensive evaluation that's factored. So we can address the quality as well as the quantity of the multi-benefit piece. We also included a minimum grant allotment of $250,000 for grants. As you're well aware, OPC is limited in their staff capacity to manage grants, and we felt that that was a fair bar to set. We also have included an exemption for disadvantaged communities to that exemption, so that if a small community, disadvantaged community, was applying for a grant that was smaller than that, they would still be an eligible applicant. So I'll run through quickly some of the screening criteria for the letters of intent, and I'll move on to the scoring criteria. So again, as Amy mentioned, this is mostly yes, no, are you an eligible applicant, do you meet Prop 1, OPC. One of the key things to point out is the sea level rise piece, which is the first box on this section of the screening criteria. And essentially, we wanted to prioritize that previous OPC resolutions as well as executive order were being incorporated into projects that could be impacted by sea level rise in the future. And we feel like that's a good component of incentivizing that piece of OPC's work. Again, you're not meant to read the whole thing right now. Here's the scoring criteria. It's been provided for you. A quick snapshot. The first section is the water action plan. So meeting the, does your project meet the goals of the water action plan? The second box is multiple benefits. So that's chapter 6 and Prop 1. And then the removes or reduces multiple stressors from the ocean is kind of the OPC piece of evaluating different proposals that come in. Because Prop 1 is, as you know, is a very broad. Chair mentioned it, from stormwater recycling to groundwater cleaning, and OPC has taken the focus on the nearshore ecosystems and nearshore environment, from coastal, estuarine watersheds and wetlands. We've also included bonus points for letters of intent and full proposal, which I'll touch base on in a minute, which this is where you get the marine managed areas bonus points, as well as advancing marine estuarine fish populations. And we've included, based upon public comment, the disadvantaged communities do receive a bonus point, incentivizing us to provide projects to them so that they have a better chance of being funded. So again, running through the scoring criteria for a full proposal, not meant to read this, but it touches on Chapter 6 of Prop 1, and then reduces multiple stressors from the ocean, which is OPC focus, and general, is this a good project, is it a good applicant, have they been successful in the past, will they most likely be successful on time in their project if they do receive funding. Again, we have bonus points for the full proposal, and based upon public comment, we have also included disadvantaged communities as bonus points, but the only change between the bonus points and the full proposal and the letter of intent is that we've given bonus points for matching funds. We feel like by the time you have a full proposal, that is going to be fleshed out more. So based upon that, the timeline and how everything works is, you know, given if the proposed guidelines were adopted, we would then move into opening a solicitation period, which we look at sometime in October, probably towards the end of October, give applicants about a month to respond to that. It's not a lengthy document. There's a template included in our proposed guidelines. We would then review those towards the end of December, depending on the vacations that everybody takes. And we would then select those applicants that did receive more than 75 points or more to submit a full proposal, which would be a much more detailed, comprehensive document that would take much longer time than the letter of intent. Once those are due, we would evaluate those within a review committee, and when we do receive, when we do evaluate them, we will recommend the highest, we will be contacting the highest awarded individuals to see, you know, how many great applications to receive in this period, what's the staff capacity like, and what we can recommend to the council for approval and adoption to enter into a grant agreement. Once the council does approve a project for funding, we do have to go through a grant agreement process with each grantee, and that generally includes a scope of work, proof of insurance, and various standard forms. Across the board as far as grants go. And with that, I'd like to thank you guys for letting me speak, and Amy and I are here for any comments or questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. I think since we have four speakers that have asked to speak on this, I will take them now so that if we have questions that come from this, we can do it. So the first one is Gene Eckerly, and Dana Murray, you are on deck.
Good afternoon, Chair Laird and members of the council. I'm Jen Eckerly. I'm an ocean policy analyst with the Natural Resources Defense Council. We want to voice our support for OPC's revised Proposition 1 guidelines, and we want to thank your staff for their hard work, their proactive outreach, and their willingness to listen and make changes in response to stakeholder concerns. We appreciate the revisions to the scoring criteria and the point allocations for projects that will provide multiple ecological benefits, which now allow for the evaluation of a range of benefits a project will provide, including water quality improvements and watershed and coastal habitat protection, as well as the quality or extent that benefits will improve or protect the aquatic environment. We also greatly appreciate that the bonus points allocated for projects that will advance the management of marine protected areas have been increased from 10 to 15. We understand that the letter of intent template now includes a checkbox for applicants to identify whether their proposal has been submitted to another Prop 1 grant program, and that OPC intends to continue to coordinate with other agencies funding projects under Prop 1. However, we continue to urge you to take additional steps to facilitate agency coordination on funding decisions, particularly with the Coastal Conservancy, the State Water Board, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We recognize that integrated evaluation criteria, identification of shared project priorities, and joint agency investment may be challenging for this initial round of funding. However, we encourage staff to keep this priority in focus and establish a process for enhancing interagency collaboration and prioritization of projects that leverage funding across state agencies for the next round. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So Dana and then Sarah from Coastkeeper Alliance, you're on deck.
Good afternoon. My name is Dana Murray. I'm the Senior Coastal Policy Manager at Heal the Bay. We've been tracking and weighing in on the Prop 1 guidelines throughout the process, and we'd like to thank OPC staff for the multiple opportunities to weigh in and have a discussion on how these guidelines are being formulated. We also want to thank OPC staff for including many of our recommendations in the revised guidelines. We're especially encouraged to see more weight given to projects that enhance marine protected areas, as well as multiple benefit projects, especially including coastal and watershed protection and water quality projects. We would still like to see more interagency coordination with funding decisions. For example, after Prop O was passed in Southern California, an oversight committee was formed to review proposed projects and identify ones that would complement one another. For Prop 1, agencies such as the State Water Board, Department of Water Resources, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Ocean Protection Council, and the Coastal Conservancy could coordinate funding decisions in order to fund projects that would have the largest impact, such as large-scale coastal wetlands restorations and groundwater remediation. Again, thank you for consideration of our comments.
Thank you. So Sarah and then Linda Sheehan from the Earth Law Center is on deck.
Good afternoon, council members. I will just echo the thanks of my co-presenters and co-commenters at NRDC and Heal the Bay. We really thank OPC, Nick, Amy, and Kat for their careful consideration and incorporation of our comments into the grant program. They've been extremely receptive and proactive about really making the guidelines effective and setting us up for success, even the first round. So thank you. From the start, the development of the guidelines has been well thought out and considerate of the nuances necessary to ensure that our bond funds achieve impactful and lasting changes for water quality and ocean health, and really proactively solicit and cultivate projects that hit the Ocean Protection Council's priority, as Amy mentioned, around resiliency to climate change, coastal water quality improvement, protection of marine managed areas, and mitigation of marine debris. In particular, we'd like to thank the OPC for specific changes to the guidelines since the initial draft, specifically including a project minimum exemption for disadvantaged communities to broaden the field of potential project proponents, despite the $250,000 cap minimum. Broadening the multi-benefit definition in a way that really addresses the underlying intent of multi-benefits with a focus on quality instead of quantity, the number of benefits, and increasing the points available for projects that benefit marine managed areas. We were initially supportive of the guidelines and even more so in light of these changes. And finally, just a note about interagency coordination. We did see the addition of a checkbox, which is helpful. I think, you know, the interagency coordination could be even more reflected in the project guidelines, but as staff presentation makes clear, this is just the beginning of the bond process, not the end. And so the interagency coordination piece will really manifest in the coming months and years, and we are very hopeful that that will occur. I know that staff will be meeting with other agencies who have already conducted their project solicitation, so we just encourage that and are here to work with staff on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda, and then we have one late ad who's on deck, Richard Sadowski.
Thank you, Chair Laird and members of the OPC. Linda Sheehan with Earth Law Center. And just a quick note to thank you for your mention of Zeke Grader. I was fortunate to see him just a few days before he passed. And as I was going out the door, he handed me a sheaf of papers, talk about tireless, handwritten, with specific instructions as to what I was due to follow up on this particular project. So he was quite a friend of the ocean and of this body, and he will be missed.
I can guarantee if you don't follow up, there'll be a lightning bolt.
Trust me, I've already passed them on with the instructions. So I did want to echo the comments thanking staff for a great job with outreach and with regard to incorporating comments. I think the final guidelines are flexible and strong and will help put you forward on the right foot. I also agree with Ms. Amanzada's comments just now that this is just the beginning, and Natural Resources Agency has a particular set of responsibilities to make sure that this process goes forward effectively, not just with regard to the OPC, but with regard to other agencies. And so I do hope as we go forward with solicitations that we'll keep revisiting, you know, are we meeting interagency collaboration and multi-benefit goals? So, for example, WCB and CDFW have significant funds for flow. And being able to be in the seat of Natural Resources Agency and pulling the OPC and these other agencies together to see how this funding could be most effective in achieving flow, which of course is good for fish and good for water quality, two of OPC's top priorities. That would be a good thing in moving forward to make sure that each solicitation is better than the last at achieving the goals of Prop 1, the Clean Water Action Plan, and COPA, which calls, of course, on the OPC to integrate and coordinate the states' laws and institutions towards ocean health. And just on that last point on ocean health, the OPC held two, I think, in the OPC SAT had two very successful workshops and discussions last year on this point. And we look forward to working with staff and the OPC on advancing this discussion and ensuring that these future solicitations move us continually toward this idea of integrated ocean health. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Richard?
Richard Sadowski, Citizen, Morro Bay. I would like to thank the staff and also this council. And I think what it boils down for a lot of just regular people is trust. And in the people that we talk to and we deal with and just the public, this council has an air of integrity and in trust, and having this money go to the OPC and have it dispersed this way, the staff did an excellent job in tightening it up and making sure that the projects that are going to be accepted are going to deal with, you know, and going to be in action and not just studies. And I just wanted to just state my thanks for your staff and for you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your comments. We're going to move it to questions and deliberation and action, and I'm going to take the liberty of asking some questions first. The first one is just one I know we talked about. I want to know the answer, which is How long is the appropriation good for? What do we have to do by when?
We have 3 years to encumber the money or commit the money and an additional 2 years to spend the money for a total of 5 years.
So it's a five-year horizon as long as it's encumbered by 3 years. And then one question I had, I think you answered, but it wasn't totally connected, and that is that I had the concern, how do we deal with people that might not have the capacity to do a massive application? And the letter of intent process is really clear that it's designed to get at that. So if somebody doesn't have to do the massive application first, they do the letter of intent. And that way, with a limited capacity, they can get their foot in the door. What kind of technical assistance will we have after the letter of intent for anybody that might still have capacity issues once we accept the letter of intent and encourage a full application?
You know, certainly the Ocean Protection Council staff would love to be helpful and available to any grant applicant. You know, I say that with the caveat that staff has a lot of other demands on their time. And so, you know, I don't want to overcommit our staff in that regard. But you know, we would be happy to help grantees, put grantees into contact with maybe more technical experts that could help with particular parts of the project. But I'm not aware of any particular pot of money within Prop 1 that's dedicated towards technical assistance. Others who are more familiar can correct me.
Okay. But it's something just at a very, very basic level we can offer, not something that's very time intensive. Then a layperson's question that I couldn't understand. When I looked at Nick's listing of all the categories, how do we know that we're not going to just end up funding things in only one category? People submit applications. We take the applications as they come. How do we have a sense that we'll have some diversity in what we fund?
I think especially with this initial call that we're – or the initial solicitation period, which we envision to be a very broad call for projects, that there's enough difference of issues and in our different public meetings in Southern California, Central California, Northern California, we've heard a variety of issues that people are interested in addressing using Prop 1 funding. So I think it's a great opportunity for people to be creative about the issues they have and how the state can help them deal with those.
Okay. And you're confident, too, that the extra 10 points for disadvantaged communities will actually work?
I hope so.
Okay. Because we have to have 10% of the grants benefit disadvantaged communities, and it's not something we can make the 90% and then say, oh, let's go back and figure out where we can get the 10. We need to be doing it as we go along. So. And one other thing, and it particularly, you know, Linda Sheehan mentioned the actual act that created us and said she was glad we were being true to the act. But the act might not be totally true to the bond. and so I am concerned that we have raised expectations because if I had, you know, my druthers, the act, the bond would have been about the act, and we could put anything we wanted to, whatever a priority was in that act. But the bond was about water quality. And so what happens if we get applications that fit our mission as the Ocean Protection Council but don't necessarily fit the bond? Have we raised expectations that people are going to apply for things that fit the act and then we get stuck? And I know that the letter of intent process helps because they don't put together a full application in the process of finding that out. But are we doing outreach beforehand to make it clear sort of what qualifies so that we haven't raised expectations and then we get a lot of letters of intent for things that are ocean programs that don't fit the bond? I mean, how are we going to be preventive with that?
Yeah, in our public meetings, we've been very, very clear that the money does come from Prop 1, and we have to meet those standards, and that's what helps with the screening criteria of the letter of intent, as well as the scoring criteria. And many of the proposed projects, you know, people are brainstorming project, asking if this would fit with Prop 1 or not. We have definitely told people no, that project does not, and then others, it's a much more clear link between Prop 1 and water quality, as well as OPC priorities.
And then that leads to just one quick comment. There's this elephant cub in the room, and that is that we have about one quarter of the amount that we have available in Prop 1 funds still on hand from Prop 84. And the Prop 84 funds don't have the same restrictions, and they might give us some flexibility. But this is not coming here right now. And I think we, at a meeting that is either our next one or the one after it, are going to have to start to think about how we want to integrate. And it might be that seeing what comes in the first round would inform us in that, because we could spend all $8 million on things that aren't eligible for Prop 1. Or if we have some really nice proposals in Prop 1 that just have some piece that doesn't qualify, and Prop 84 will help round out the entire proposal, we can do it. And yet, sort of just bringing it to the council, we have this money, what do we do without having some basis to do that, might be a problem. So I just want to highlight that that's out there, and that we as a group still have to figure out how we're going to deal with that and integrate it. But I always suspect that people are salivating at the thought that it is available. And that was originally something like $80 or $90 million in Prop 84. And my view is that about $70 million of it went out the door, as long as it met what OPC's things were, without sort of this more global a view of how to be strategic and leverage other money. And so it leaves us in a position of having to be very strategic about the small amount that's left. And so I just want to acknowledge that, because that's out there, and it's something we're going to have to figure out what to do. That completes my questions. Other council member questions? Gordon.
There were several comments or questions on interagency coordination, and I wonder if you might elaborate a little bit more on how we envision doing that.
Yes.
And in particular, with respect to identifying other grant programs under Prop 1 and making sure that we're getting the most bang for our buck.
Yes. So as you may or may not be aware, several other agencies are already in the solicitation phase. I think some have even closed. And that being said, they're going to be receiving proposals, or I've already received proposals, and we have been in talks with them already, and we're planning to meet with them. This includes Coastal Conservancy, DFW, State Water Board, Delta Conservancy, Wildlife Conservation Board, you know, similar entities within Chapter 6 that have a very similar program. The specifics may be a little bit different. At the beginning, you know, as it was said several times, this is the first time we would have to do that with Prop 1. So figuring out the nuances of timing with the different boards and councils and commissions that people need to go to, and the different solicitation periods, is an obstacle we can overcome in time with maybe a joint solicitation period. I don't think a joint proposal will likely happen, but definitely joint solicitation periods is an intent, and all the other agencies that we've been in communication with, the ones I listed, are hearing the same comments. They're well aware that they need to do that as well, and are definitely committed to the intent of doing interagency coordination on leveraging our funds, leveraging agency capacity, technical savvy.
Okay, so for this first round, obviously we're not doing a joint solicitation, but how do you envision actually trying to do interagency coordination in this round in particular?
With several other agencies already having received applications, I think that gives us an opportunity to kind of see what they got and anticipate what we will be receiving and where OPC fits in better than another agency's priorities are, and seeing what types of projects people are just bringing to the table, and how we can leverage the different entities. Specifically, when we if and when we do open the solicitation sometime in the end of October, many of the other agencies will be starting to work more closely with the applicants to take them to their boards and councils for approval, and that will definitely be something we'll be looking at to see how they're doing it and how we can do that along with them in the second or third solicitation as the years go on.
Yeah, no, I would just add that we had a meeting with many of the other state agencies that Nick just mentioned maybe a month ago, and I believe we're having a follow-up meeting on October 13th, if memory serves me right. Again, as Nick said, some of the agencies are a little bit further ahead in their processes. State Coastal Conservancy and I believe DFW, they have solicitations that close on September 30th. So we're just slightly out of sync with them, but we do have every intention of continuing this dialogue.
That complete your, any other questions or comments? Bill.
Thank you. Is the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the purpose of the check the box is to indicate that an application may be applying for Prop 1 funding from more than one department?
Correct.
How many of your sister agencies have a similar approach?
I know it's included in DFWs right now, currently. I'm not sure specifically with any other agencies, but in communication with them, they're all on the same page. They've heard the comments. They're completely on board with working together to see how we can both work together to, you know, get the maximum benefit from this money.
Okay. It's probably not a fair question for you two, but I guess my concern would be how do the agencies that don't have a check-the-box approach plan to maximize multiple benefits?
I think it may be a little more grueling process of, you know, these are the applications we received, show us what applications you received or something like that, or we feel that this is much more in line with your program, just further okay. Dialoguing and figuring out how to do coordination.
Nick's being very polite, because I would have said you have to ask them. Other questions or comments, Mike?
I'm a little bit concerned about disadvantaged communities in a couple of different ways. One is their ability to come up with matching, particularly local matching funds. Two, having sufficient and appropriate resources to not so much to do the letter of intent, but to do the full-blown proposal. And in part because it clearly requires a lot of analysis to score well and have access to that analysis. So if they're not don't have established relationships with an academic institution or NGOs or whatever, they, you know, how's it going to happen unless, I guess you could hire a consultant, but where are they going to get the money for a consultant? So what are you thinking about in that kind of situation?
So currently the way our guidelines are proposed, we do not require a match. You get, I believe it's 5 bonus points for 100% match. And again, I think the letter of intent gives a good opportunity of seeing if there's potentially a disadvantaged community that's interested in a project, and maybe there's another project in the area that if those two projects were combined, that could be a much more, provide more multi-benefits and could leverage the different staff of the different entities that are partnering together.
Let me ask a question. Because if it, given what you responded to in answer to the question, if you get 5 points for a match and you get how much for a disadvantaged community? 10. Okay, that's 5 points to the advantage. But if it turns out that that's not working as well as we had hoped, and this is the first of 3 solicitations, we would try to adjust it to give more benefit to the disadvantaged communities in the future solicitations, wouldn't we? Or wouldn't you at least recommend that to us?
Yes, and I was going to turn to our legal counsel. My understanding is that we can amend these grant guidelines at any point, and maybe I'll turn to her for the specifics on what that would entail.
Yeah, I know you can amend your guidelines in any round. You'd have three public workshops to do that in the way that you did here. I think one thing I would probably be advising based on that question would be the capacity of the community to actually meet the requirements of Prop 1. So, you know, when they ask me for legal advice on this, I tend to ask them whether they think the points are being driven to such a degree that the community could follow through and finish the project. So hopefully the 10 points work, but certainly you could amend it, yes.
But the thing is that after at least one round, based on our experience, whatever it is that might have been discouraging to people, we are going to try to address so it doesn't exist in the next two rounds, right? Because we have a requirement for disadvantaged communities, and it's something that even if it weren't required, we should be doing. So we have to figure out a way to make it work. Okay. For those of you at home, people were nodding. Other questions or comments? Taylor.
The requirement for disadvantaged communities, so that pertains to all of Section 79731, so all the money that's going to conservancies. So you, of all that money, was it 10% needs to be spent within a disadvantaged community? Am I correct?
I believe that's Prop 1 in general.
Yeah, yeah, so it's 10% of each pot. So they're going to try and, right, the math's going to come out the same, but it's 10% of each pot.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Does anybody have a motion?
I move to accept the staff's recommendation for the guidelines and
second.
Motion and a second to approve the guidelines. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much for the comments, for all the participation along the way, and for the staff work. And now the big job comes.
Thank you.
We will move on to item number 5, which is consideration of adoption of a resolution regarding the Marine Protected Area Statewide Leadership Team and Work Plan. I think Cindy Dawson is going to present on this.
Thank you, Chair Laird. Good afternoon, council members. I'm Cindy Dawson, and I'm the Marine Protected Area Policy Advisor for the OPC. I'm happy to be here today to present to you the work of the MPA statewide leadership team, including the recent completion of a work plan covering fiscal years 15-16 through 17-18. This work represents a truly significant milestone in are coming together as a state with our partners to ensure that our marine protected areas are going to be managed, well managed into the future and thriving. As you know, through a public-private partnership that was launched in 2004, using a science-based and stakeholder-driven process, the state designated a network of 124 marine protected areas that was completed for the four coastal regions in 2012. We've moved through the design, designation, and implementation phases of that process and are now turning our attention to the long-term management for the MPA network. A critical first step in the transition from implementation to management was the drafting of the California Collaborative Approach Marine Protected Areas Partnership Plan. The plan outlines a shared vision for how the state and its partners will work together to successfully manage the MPA network. The partnership plan was endorsed by the OPC and the Fish and Game Commission last December and more clearly defines the partners and the relationships necessary for successful management of the network. And it also directed the OPC to develop a work plan for the MPA statewide leadership team. The partnership plan recognizes that no one agency or group has the knowledge, capacity, or resources to manage our MPA network in isolation. So responding to that, Chair Laird convened a meeting of the expanded MPA statewide leadership team this past April that added team members that have significant authority to affect the MPA statewide network. The leadership team is currently made up of 10 members, and there are plans to add additional members as required moving forward. From the initial meeting in April, a working group was convened, of program manager level staff to develop the content for the work plan. Each member brought to the table their extensive knowledge of their agency and MPA-related programs, as well as information from stakeholders that was gathered through the public process to develop the partnership plan. The director of the MPA Collaborative Network also holds a seat on the team and thus provided another conduit of information for stakeholders' priorities to be reflected in the document. The leadership team has identified four focal areas that encompass all the components necessary for successful management of the MPA network statewide. Those areas include outreach and education, enforcement and compliance, research and monitoring, and policy and permitting. Active engagement in all four of these areas are required for success. The work plan is organized around these four areas, and it identifies priorities, key priorities, actions, and outcomes, as well as building in timelines and accountability for team members that are part of the document. So I'd like to provide you now with just a very high-level view of the content of the work plan itself and go over the shared strategic priorities that were identified and agreed upon by all the team members in each of the four focal areas. So we'll start with outreach and education. And the strategic priorities in that area include to build the support and durability of the MPA network, to create a broad understanding of regulations and increase compliance, to develop consistent messaging. An example of a key action under these strategic priorities would be something like the development of a statewide outreach and education plan to coordinate efforts among state agencies and private partners to ensure that we're having accurate, efficient, and effective messaging to the broad constituency. Excuse me. Moving on to enforcement and compliance. The strategic priority for enforcement and compliance includes a wide range of activities to increase the capacity and effectiveness of enforcement. Some key actions under this particular priority area include exploring ways to use technology to increase the effectiveness enforcement. That would be something like implementing a tool like a records management system for the state so that they can track citations through time. Maintaining and enhancing cooperative enforcement efforts with local, state, and other federal agencies. And increasing judicial and enforcement officers' awareness of the value of MPAs as well as their understanding of the regulations themselves. Moving on to research and monitoring, key priorities for that area that were identified by the leadership team include establishing a benchmark of ecosystem and socioeconomic conditions, designing and implementing a partnership-based monitoring program, and developing an approach to statewide MPA network assessment. All these priorities in the research and monitoring area, in all the areas really, but especially in this particular focal area, build on previous work and are focused on providing management-relevant data that can inform decisions. A key action that cuts across all of these priorities is the development of a statewide long-term monitoring program, which will draw on lessons from the baseline programs. It will be focused on continuing to leverage and develop partnerships, and will also be linked back to the monitoring framework and the monitoring plans that have been developed at a regional level. Moving on to policy and permitting, the strategic priorities identified in that area is to improve the governance of the MPA network, to integrate the Marine Life Protection Act and MPA network goals and objectives, and partnership-based approach into relevant management documents, and to enhance the protection for MPA resources, and to identify marine resource enhancement mitigation opportunities and impact avoidance strategies. A key action under this area is formalizing and documenting the existing processes among the permitting agencies of communication and coordination that they use for permitting. This was identified as one of the key actions that will help us identify any gaps in that communication so that they can be addressed moving forward. This area highlights the truly collaborative focus of the document and the commitment of agencies to improve the effectiveness and efficiencies related to MPA network management. So, This work plan is truly an innovative document. It breaks down traditional silos, and it commits agencies to work together among themselves and with their partners in new ways. The document was reviewed and approved by the directors of all the agency all the members of the team, and reflects the shared priorities and the commitments of those members over the next 3 years. So before you today, you have a resolution that resolves to endorse the MPA statewide leadership team work plan for fiscal year 15-16 through 17-18, which identifies strategic priorities, key actions, and outcomes for the effective MPA network management. It further resolves that through the implementation of the work plan, California's natural resource agencies and supporting partners are committed to effective communication and coordination guided by mutual benefit, trust, transparency, and accountability to support the effective management of the NPA network. And finally, it further resolves that the OPC staff will continue to lead the NPA statewide leadership team, including completing periodic updates of the work plan to ensure it reflects emerging issues, learning from previous actions, and is resulting in the continued successful management of the MPA network. So thank you for your attention, and I will take any questions or comments you have.
Let me we have two people that want to speak, and let's take them first. Although, okay, Dr. Ricky Dunsmore, and then on deck is Jen Eckerly.
Good afternoon, Chairman Laird and Ocean Protection Council members, Executive Director Coleman, and staff. My name is Dr. Ricky Dunsmore. I'm the Program Director for the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation Marine Protected Areas Program. We would like to take this opportunity to thank the Ocean Protection Council and partner agencies and organizations for your hard work and congratulate you on the Leadership Team Work Plan and applaud your collaborative approach that is being embraced. Over the past 8 years, we have been working to improve public awareness of the Marine Protected Areas Network and have accomplished quite a lot. An incredible wealth of outreach resources now exist. Many of these are available on the www.californiampas.org website. Early efforts, which were informed by the best and the brightest professionals from external communications firms and interpretive specialists in the conservation field, focused initially on interpretive centers, state parks, and aquaria in every region. They produced trainings, exhibits, interpretive and regulatory signage, films, and engaging events for the public. More recently, we've targeted the ocean recreation community, working with harbor masters to test a variety of outreach products and approaches, including production of waterproof, tearproof brochures that we now have for all major harbors in California. In the past 2 years, the Ocean Protection Council has provided funds to expand initial signage efforts to fill gaps and support the collaboratives to increase grassroots engagement and implementation. The rewards of this monumental effort are now just being realized as partners and collaboratives across the state now have readily accessible content to tailor to their specific needs. Recent successes includes partnerships with large retail marine stores such as West Marine and England Marine, multiple articles in newspapers and magazines and fishing rags, collaborations with the Department of Boating and Waterways and the Seabird Protection Network, and inclusion of MPA content on popular websites, mobile applications, and tide charts. We are very impressed with the many contributions of the collaboratives and the partner organizations and are pleased to serve as a resource to partners and help guide them towards existing resources for standardized messaging and approved formats to help foster a statewide identity for our Marine Protected Areas network. Many of the key actions that are identified in the Leadership Team Work Plan are ones that our organization have created or actively has underway, and we look forward to working together to ensure that our partners don't reinvent the wheel, but rather build upon and leverage existing resources and relationships in a coordinated fashion. We look forward to continuing to work with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Boating and Waterways, State Parks, and the Ocean Protection Council to effectively implement the network of MPAs. And I brought you all some written comments, handouts that has examples of some of these products that I'm not sure how we distribute.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Jen Eckerly, NRDC. We want to thank the Ocean Protection Council for convening the statewide leadership team to facilitate a coordinated approach to MPA outreach, monitoring, enforcement, and policy. Collaboration among state partners will help integrate the state's MPA network into the fabric of California's ocean governance and will support the long-term durability of our protected areas. We want to thank staff, particularly Cindy Dawson, and the partner agencies for developing a plan that outlines clear actions, outcomes, task leads, and timelines for getting things done. We are particularly pleased to see specific actions focused on improving MPA enforcement and integrating MPA protections into agency decision-making in a coordinated way. We would like to provide two suggestions for actions to be included into the policy and permitting focal area of the plan. First, we would like to see a task that directs the State Water Board to designate state water quality protected areas that would maintain natural water quality to protect marine life and habitats within state marine parks and state marine conservation areas. This general protection designation was approved by the board through an ocean plan amendment back in October 2012, but identification of candidate sites and a process for designating them as state water quality protected areas has not yet begun. Second, we recommend that the work plan include an action to identify a mechanism for mitigation fund acceptance and allocation to support MPA management. The strategic priority 4 in the work plan does include a range of actions and performance indicators targeting marine restoration and mitigation. However, those items are focused on identifying project opportunities and not on how funds will be received or which agency or agencies will be responsible for their distribution. My colleague Sarah Amanzada from Coastkeeper Alliance will go into some further detail on that in general comment later. Overall, we think this work plan is an excellent roadmap for how California's coastal management agencies will leverage resources and work in partnership to support management of the state's MPA network. As Ricky just mentioned, we want to highlight that many of the actions listed in the work plan have already been undertaken or are underway within the NGO community and also in local residents, and we look forward to continuing to work with the statewide leadership team to reinforce these efforts. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The matter is back before the council. Let me just ask one clarifying question, which is obvious. But in last December's meeting, we endorsed the MPA partnership plan. This is just the work plan to implement what we already endorsed, right?
Correct.
Okay. Just for people's information. Other questions or comments? Somebody motivated enough to make a motion? Motion by Gordon, second by Brian. Any further discussion? And that is to approve the recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much, Cindy. We'll move to item number 6, which is informational. It's an update on the Marine Protected Area signage project.
Yes, thank you. Hello, council members. Momentary technical. I
presentations. There we go. Mostly beautiful photos of installed signs. So I want to make sure that that's on the screen for everyone to enjoy. At the February 26, 2014 meeting of the council, you approved a $350,000 grant to the Monterey Bay Sanctuary Foundation, now known as the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation, to improve public enjoyment and understanding of California's marine protected area network through a comprehensive signage program at key coastal access points for California visitors and residents. As the funds originated from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the department is the primary agency charged with management of the MPA network, Ocean Protection Council staff have worked closely with the Sanctuary Foundation and the department throughout all aspects of this project. This project included three key tasks. First was to inventory existing signage along the California coastline related to marine protected areas, and this task was completed fairly early in this project. The second was to design consistent signage templates and fabricate new signage for high priority areas. And third, to acquire necessary permits and install signage. And I'll now describe the progress on these last two tasks in more detail. Building off of the existing signage inventory, Sanctuary Foundation worked with local partners, OPC staff, and the department to identify 189 priority locations for new signs. And of these new signs, 93 were regulatory in nature and 96 were interpretive. And these signs were placed, sites for these signs were selected at a variety of coastal access points as well as at harbors and marinas throughout the state. A large portion of this project was developing standardized templates for both regulatory and interpretive signage. And you can see examples of each of four types of signs on the screen. Regulatory signs, shown at the bottom left, include no take or no collecting signs specific to the regulations for that MPA, as well as you are here signs showing the location of the viewer relative to boundaries for nearby MPAs, as well as important local landmarks. Interpretive signs, shown on the right side of the screen, include both general interpretive panels highlighting unique attributes of local MPAs and harbor panels, which emphasize boundaries and take restrictions of MPAs located near harbors, ports, and marinas. The Sanctuary Foundation consulted a wide range of local partners as sign content was developed, ensuring that each sign reflected its local context. In particular, tribal members were extensively involved in creating signs for several locations. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, particularly the Law Enforcement Division, was heavily involved in the review process for content creation, ensuring that MPA boundaries and regulations were accurately represented for all signs. No organization, governmental or otherwise, has attempted to install signage at this scale before in the state of California. And while there have been challenges during this the permitting process, OPC staff, along with the Sanctuary Foundation and the department, have worked closely with staff at the Coastal Commission, Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and local jurisdictions throughout the state to obtain the necessary permits for this project. These signs have been primarily permitted through two consolidated coastal development permits from the Coastal Commission. One for 115 signs in Del Norte through San Luis Obispo counties was approved at the Commission's May meeting, and these locations are shown in blue on the screen. The second for 64 signs in Santa Barbara through San Diego counties was approved at the Commission's August meeting, and these locations are shown in yellow. OPC staff and the Sanctuary Foundation have also collaborated on permitting for six signs through the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, shown in green, as well as separate processes for two signs at the Port of Los Angeles and two signs at the San Diego Unified Port District, shown in pink. Approval for the BCD signs and those at the San Diego Unified Port District have been received, and we recently determined that no permits are needed for the signs at the Port of Los Angeles, and therefore, if you've been following, permitting for this project is now complete, which is very exciting. Through these permitting processes, OPC staff have had a unique opportunity to engage a novel sector in conversations about the marine protected area network. Many of the city and county planners and managers we spoke with had no or only limited knowledge about the MPA network prior to this project. Many of these individuals, in addition to being supportive of the signage project itself, were excited to learn more about the MPA network and explore future ways to support this important asset for California's ocean. Now the fun part. So I'm going to show a series of photos of some of these install signs. So installation is underway for all permitted signs, and 64% of the signs to date have been installed statewide. And these photos show several examples of this installed signage at various locations along the coast provided by key partners on this project, as well as some OPC staff members. Thank you.
We that completes your presentation?
That completes my presentation, yes.
Well, thank you very much. And I know this is informational, but there might be some questions. But first, let's hear from the four people that wanted to speak. And the first one is Anna Weinstein, and Dana Murray is on deck. And a couple people checked they wanted to speak in favor of the staff recommendation. And just for the record, this is information only. So, Anna, are you somewhere?
Thank you, Secretary Laird and members of the council. I just want to say that we're in strong support of these signs. I'm speaking in capacity as I'm with Audubon California, Marine Program Director, and I'm fortunate to be a statewide lead on a wonderful program to understand and protect the black oyster catcher in California, which is an iconic rocky intertidal shorebird that's threatened by climate change. In fact, it's one of the top threatened coastal birds from climate change, according to a Point Blue analysis. There's a lot of state and federal partners in this program, agency biologists, a lot of in-kind time from these agencies. So in addition to generating baseline demographic information, I've heard from this network of about 80 observers from state and federal agencies and the public that these signs have absolutely made a difference for this amazing marine bird, because its disturbance is actually a big factor in limiting the nesting success of this bird and reducing its productivity. And so what I've heard is that in the outreach activities that all these participants have been doing, especially Audubon chapters and state parks, the signs complement their own outreach activities and have served to work together to actually greatly enhance public awareness of a black oyster catcher so that people using the coastal areas, fishermen, kayakers, marine life collectors outside of marine reserves and also within marine reserves, people who are just exploring the rocky intertidal, who aren't collecting anything but exploring, it's really helped the network share information about this bird and help protect it. So really want to thank you. Specifically, Salt Point State Park and Van Dam State Park were cited as areas that have really been helpful for the oyster catcher. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Then Dana Murray, but Dr. Ricky Dunsmore is on deck.
Good afternoon. Dana Murray from Heal the Bay. I'll be brief, but I wanted to say thank you to Morgan from the Ocean Protection Council, also to staff at the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation, NRDC staffers who helped the local collaboratives make these signs a reality, and thank you to OPC for also helping with the signage project. These have been a long time coming, multiple-year project, and had so many different perspectives assisting in the design and what they wanted these to encompass. Also looking forward, I can't wait till we get more signs along our coast. I know right as we finish this. And one recommendation I have for the signage projects in the future are to incorporate more bilingual signs, especially incorporating Spanish throughout the state. We were fortunate to get bilingual signs in Los Angeles County, and we really appreciate the Marine Sanctuary Foundation working with us on that. So I think this is really something to be celebrated. This is a milestone in MPA implementation, and we've already had many volunteers and members of the public sending us pictures out in the field with these MPA signs. And I think they're just a visual reminder of our special places along the coast. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then Dr. Ricky Dunsmore, and on deck is Jen Eckerling.
Good afternoon again, Chairman Laird and Ocean Protection Council members. My name is Ricky Dunsmore, the Marine Protected Areas Director for the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation. Literally a round of applause should be cheered for what has been accomplished in just a short 15-month period with the statewide signage project. This project could not have been achieved without the extraordinary partnerships multiple people across the state who have contributed to the success of this monumental effort. Additionally, the Ocean Protection Council staff, and specifically Cindy Dawson and Morgan Ivins-Duran, should be commended for their role in supporting the permitting process. Other people are city managers, lifeguards, enforcement wardens, state and county parks, harbor masters, marine operators, non-governmental organizations such as Natural Resources Defense Council, Heal the Bay, tribal communities, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife have all contributed to our success collectively of more than doubling the interpretive and regulatory signs for the marine protected areas across California. There were many unanticipated outcomes, but the largest of this has been the momentum gained, just as Anna was just talking about, and the relationships that were fostered with grassroots partners to expand our outreach potential. We are actively now using and leveraging the successful aspects of this project. For instance, things like these are now getting distributed in bait and tackle shops and kayak locations and are excellent resource tools for education across our state. State and federal agencies and public polling have identified that signage is an important piece of compliance, and we continue to receive additional requests for both interpretive and regulatory signage across the state. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife has reinforced the value and the need, and the leadership work plan calls for the next round of priority signage at priority locations. We recommend focusing on harbors, marinas, and boat launches to contribute to the outreach of the boating community. Through the close engagement with partners in the field, we have developed excellent relationships, and we look forward to helping to fill the gaps and leverage the materials and outcome that we have all worked so hard to achieve. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Jen Eckerly.
Jen Eckerly, NRDC. I'm not going to lie, when I see those pictures of those signs, I get a little tear in my eye. They make me very happy to see. So I just want to thank the OPC for its grant to the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation for supporting MPA signs throughout the state. As you've heard from previous speakers, this public education effort is leveraging local partners, fostering community stewardship, and creating a social infrastructure that will support ongoing MPA management. These signs are concrete evidence of the collaborative nature of MPA implementation in California. The language and photographs were all developed by local residents from the MPA collaboratives in close collaboration with staff from the department and OPC. These signs will raise awareness of the value of these special coast and ocean places and help improve compliance. This statewide sign project is just one tool in the broader collaborative effort to improve MPA compliance and enforcement, efforts that include legislation like AB 298, improving prosecution through warden and DA trainings, and technological improvements for tracking violations and improving warden efficiency, like the ones that I highlighted for you at your last meeting that were outlined in NRDC's enforcement report. So I want to thank you again for your focus on this issue, and thanks for your time.
Thank you. That was informational. Any comments from Mike?
The signage is absolutely beautiful and fantastic, and love to see it. I do have a question for you guys. Is there a, and I know you're starting to focus on additional signage, but I've got a concern that there really needs to be an inspection and maintenance plan and some dollars behind it. In my community, there's a lot of signage at beaches that, number one, they deteriorate over time. Number two, certain amount of vandalism. Some of them have become unreadable, and I'd hate to see these beautiful signs end up like that. So, what's the plan?
That's a great question, and definitely something that we've been aware of as this project has gone forward. There were some technical aspects to the design and fabrication of the signage that should address some of those concerns. UV coating to reduce fading of the signs over time, anti-graffiti resistant coating to hopefully help at least remove the vandalism once it occurs. For a lot of these locations, you know, there's a lot of signs going in at state parks signs going in, you know, local city and county operated areas where we've been working with those partners on the ground, you know, be it NGOs or state or local governments to see to that long-term maintenance of that signage.
wanted to add to that that we've also been working with the department enforcement folks and their TIP 411 and been working with the MPA collaboratives for people to be able to actually text in when they see a sign that's degraded so that we can start be more responsive and get the correct party out there to go ahead and fix those. So we're going to continue to work on expanding that program so that we can have it across the state.
Go.
At least consider some regular visual inspection schedule. Just at a minimum.
Absolutely. And again, that one of the groups we're piloting with is MPA Watch. So they're out there on a regular basis. So I think we're going to start building with them and then continue to figure out how we can have a more regular inspection schedule. Thank you for that.
Other questions or comments? I would just say in closing that this was a long time coming, and I know it was very controversial at times, and just wonderful that it's happening. And last month, I was north of Fort Bragg, and we pulled over to look at something, and there was one of these signs. And I got very excited, and my spouse was like, "You have been at this too long." When you're just getting excited by these signs, you're weird. So it was just in the middle of nowhere. It was wonderful. Okay, well, thank you very much. We appreciate that. And we will move to public comment on non-agenda items, and we have four. So let's get to it. Anna Weinstein, followed up by Sarah from Coastkeeper.
Thank you. I'm Anna Weinstein of Audubon, California, and my comments pertain to Pacific Herring, a foundational prey item in the California Current in California. I'm here representing the six-member industry department and NGO group that developed the blueprint for a Pacific Herring fishery management plan in California, and this group will go on to serve as a steering committee for the FMP process once it initiates. And I'm also representing the West Coast Forage Coalition, comprised of Pew, Oceana, Ocean Conservancy, Earth Justice, and Audubon. Our coalition's top priorities include the Herring FMP and developing conforming regulations for the very forward-looking 2012 unmanaged forage policy of the Fish and Game Commission. As you know, Dr. Jeff Schester of our Herring Steering Group submitted a proposal to OPC at the summer meeting. 2015 for potential OPC participation in the FMP. And I'm happy to report that since then, our group has raised more than half of the total cost in private funds that would leverage an OPC investment. And so OPC investment in the FMP would help to support strategic plan objectives 3.1, 6.1, 6.2 pertaining to the governance of California fisheries. Specifically, it will reduce costs of the annual rulemaking process that the department has to go through every year, which has been cited for years as burdensome and expensive and onerous to the department. The FMP will ensure precautionary fishing. We have early agreement among our group, the industry leaders, environmental representatives, and the department on the frame of a harvest control rule. And this will go far to prevent controversy scuttling the process as it moves forward. And third, the FMP will support habitat protection for spawning herring. And I'd like to point out that some of you may be aware there's some alarming situations going on with herring spawning habitat in the state. There's a big threat in Humboldt Bay to expand oyster farming in the eelgrass Hapsee. That's the third most important herring spawning site in California. And finally, the FMP will serve, this is very exciting, to test hypotheses developed As the MLA master plan review process kicks off, we're in strong support of this process that will move the state to a position where it can fund and complete FMPs at a fraction of the costs that they cost now while still retaining essential elements of required by the MLMA. So we really look forward to working with OPC staff to submit a revised proposal for consideration in December. We thank the OPC for its consideration, and I'm happy to take any questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. Sarah, you're up from Coastkeeper, and then Richard Sadowski, you're on deck.
Good afternoon again, council members. Sarah Amanzada, I'm the executive director for California Coastkeeper Alliance. I neglected to introduce myself last time. I represent 12 California waterkeeper organizations spanning the coast from the Oregon border down to San Diego. Today, I will provide an update on the one-stroke cooling policy mitigation fee on behalf of our member California waterkeepers and on behalf of NRDC and Heal the Bay. Our organizations have been working with the State Water Board to protect the marine environment from the intake of seawater for more than a decade by developing and implementing the one-stroke cooling policy, a policy that requires the phase-out of open ocean intakes for cooling electric generators. I spoke about this issue very briefly at the last meeting and just want to provide sort of an update and some ideas about next steps to the council. On August 18th, the State Water Board adopted a resolution to delegate authority over once-through cooling interim mitigation fees to the State Board's executive director, as we expected and as discussed at the last meeting. There will now be a public comment period to allow for a review of once-through cooling facilities mitigation plans when they are submitted to the State Water Board later this fall. We will be reviewing those plans to ensure that facilities are properly mitigating their once-through cooling impacts through projects that contribute so substantially to the productivity and protection of our marine life habitats. At this stage, we remain concerned that the Water Board is unprepared or could use additional support to begin the process of assessing the plant-by-plant interim mitigation activities. The resolution adopted does not create a process or set standards for how interim mitigation will be assessed, paid, or utilized, nor is there an interagency plan in place to determine the best use of mitigation funds. The OPC has previously played a critical role in protecting marine life from once-through cooling power plants by helping support needed interagency communication and action, and I encourage OPC to again assume a leadership role, particularly in the critical coming months as the once-through cooling policy enters an important stage of implementation. And I'll offer just a few needs for assistance and ideas in the coming months, and I'd also like to ask that respectfully request that the council consider agendizing this matter at the December meeting so that we could continue the discussion and perhaps invite board staff and members to join us. But I'll offer just a few examples of needed assistance or engagement from OPC. First is working with the State Water Board to determine the best use of once-through cooling mitigation funds to replace marine life productivity. Second would be to coordinate with the Water Board to establish an interagency mitigation program. I spoke about there isn't really an interagency plan in place, and such a plan would be useful. Oh, that is a severe warning.
Yeah, I said buzzer, but it's basically...
It's quite alarming.
Yeah, the trap door right before the podium will be going in about 5 seconds.
Well, I can leave it there. I'll just sort of, now I'm terrified.
It's a big smile for being terrified.
I will just, again, sort of reiterate my request that we perhaps agendize this item for the December meeting and can have a larger discussion. It's somewhat of a complex issue, obviously, and I think it would be very beneficial. So thank you for considering that.
Thank you very much. And then we're going to move to Richard Sadowski, and Dana Murray is on deck for the last word.
Richard Sadowski, Citizen Morro Bay. I'd like to mention, first of all, thank the OPC in collaboration with the California Coastal Commission, working on getting the local coastal plans, the LCPs, up to date. And the need for that to happen there should be a sense of urgency there because of what we know about what we've studied. And, you know, you got the El Nino, but on a grander scale, the sea level rise and climate change. Also, we have a disconnect a little bit when it gets down to the local levels. And a lot of times the local staff is waiting for regulation or waiting for something to come from the Sacramento down. Yet the evidence and data regarding certain aspects of that could be addressed in sea level rise and climate change are present around us all the time. And I think the LCPs need to be more like a living document where these tools are available currently and can be dealt with at a proactive level as they get developed. And the other thing I would like to mention is the California State Lands Commission. I was doing a little research on the B3015, where the CEQA analysis for greenhouse gases. I think that state lands, there's got to be a oversight where you. I like the quote from Mikhail Gorbachev years ago, and it was made popular by former President Reagan: "Trust but verify." And I think that is a kind of a mindset that would really help kind of our local agencies, knowing that there's eyes seeing, you know, looking over what is being done and how it's being accomplished in a proactive manner. And then finally, I once again would like to thank your staff, always being available, just even to just the regular people, you know, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your comments. And then Dana Murray.
Dana Murray, Heal the Bay. I just wanted to give a public comment on what Secretary Laird started the meeting with, and that's Coastal Cleanup Day. Heal the Bay manages all of LA County's sites on Coastal Cleanup Day, and I have some numbers to share with you. In Los Angeles County alone, we had almost 10,000 volunteers come out on Saturday to pick up over 20,000 pounds of trash at over 50 coastal and inland sites. And we want to thank especially the Coastal Commission for their leadership with Coastal Cleanup Day. But I also want to use this to highlight the importance of legislation and policy to prevent trash in our communities in the first place. We want to extend a lot of gratitude for the OPC submitting a support letter for the trash policy. And we think that going forward, it'd be great if the Ocean Protection Council could help follow the trash policy implementation and serve as a liaison when needed. For example, we've noticed that there's a little bit of miscommunication between the state board and regional water boards implementing and knowing about the trash policy, so any interagency coordination on that would be much appreciated. But I think that this Coastal Cleanup Day on Saturday really shows how Californians can come together and how much we all care about our coastal environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate all the public comments. That brings us to a close in the meeting, but I want to make one comment about what's listed as item 8, which is arrangements for next meeting. December 7th is listed as our next meeting, and a lot of people referred to our December meeting, but it is still a possible moving target just given people's schedules and near the holidays. And so just stay tuned, and over the next few weeks, if we can't really guarantee that we're going to have good participation, it could well be moved, but that is just the working meeting date for now. With that, thanks everybody for a very efficient participatory meeting, and we will stand adjourned.